We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin.
Hello, and welcome to Inner Dimensions.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
I'm your host, Catherine Hannon, and today we'll be talking about everyone's favorite science mystery, black holes. We're going to be covering a lot of ground today. I'm going to be throwing a bunch of science at you, but I hope you'll also keep in mind that black holes are bigger than their mathematical equation, theoretically, philosophically, and physically. We'll also be welcoming a guest speaker, Dr. Leah Medeiros, a current National Science Foundation Astronomy and Astrophysics Postdoctoral Fellow at the Institute for Advanced Study. So, let's get started.
And what's really interesting too is that they purposely did it wrong. In the movie, you see this ring that's symmetric, which in the situation that they have and the, you know, system that they have, that wouldn't be the case. And the scientists that they were talking about definitely told them that no, it's not going to be symmetric, but they just thought it looked prettier.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. The wise men at their end know dark is right, because their words had forked no lightning. Do not go gentle into that good night. Do not go gentle into that good night is a poem by Dylan Thomas that was published in 1951. However, you may more recently remember it from the movie Interstellar, starring Matthew McConaughey and Michael Caine. The poem is used as a metaphor of motion in the film, propelling it towards the only possible outcome. No spoiler alerts needed, but seriously, if you haven't seen it and are into science fiction, go watch it. I first became interested in black holes because I wanted to see how they were portrayed in science media versus science journalism. It was an experiment, you might say. In this context, media implies a source of information being pushed towards and digested by the masses. Journalism is popular science works that stem from an academic source. At first, it might seem like there are no comparisons or contrasts, but I can assure you, they are there. Science media tends to push facts towards the public that may not have a good science backing, but do tell a good story. Science journalism is rooted in science, but who really wants to read a case study that is 30 pages long when you can find out the answer in the abstract? I think I can answer the overarching question with an example. This podcast, I would strongly argue, is science journalism because it extends directly from academic sources. Most of, if not all, the words I am saying, or will be saying, can be backed up with science. Science media, such as the novel The Sword of Rhiannon, on the other hand, of which I would argue is a perfect example of something that is rooted in imagination, has a dash of science in it, but is written with another audience in mind than a scientific one. We'll look at more examples of science media versus science journalism later, but first, black holes. After hearing the word, the next logical conclusion for the human brain is to go, what is it? A black hole, as defined by Cosmos, is a region of space within which the force of gravity is so strong that nothing, not even light, can escape its event horizon. Black holes just might be the most interesting hole in space. But hold up, they are literal holes. So why are humans so fascinated with them? Easy, because we know so little about them, and the short of it is, when humans find something we don't know about, we want to discover everything there is about it. Right away. Essentially, it's the reason things such as Discovery Channel even exist. It boils down to this. Humans are storytelling animals. We have an innate social function that allows us to fill in the gaps of our knowledge by using our imagination and weaving stories and myths that have been around for a very long time. Black holes are a relatively new concept in the field of cosmology and even in science itself. Relatively being about 100 years or so. They've existed far longer than that. There is not much known about them that can explain why they exist, what they are made of, or what their scientific function is. Black holes just are. The idea of a black hole dates back to Albert Einstein's proposed theory of relativity in 1916. Ever since then, their proposed existence sparked creativity and imagination in a way no one had ever seen before or anticipated. Black holes quickly became the hottest items in the science literature, film, and television markets. After they were proven to exist in 1971, fascination with these enigmas of space has only increased, along with our knowledge about them. We now know about their radiation waves, time dilation, and event horizon. If you want to learn more specifically about the technicalities of black holes, links are posted in the description box for you to peruse. However, humanity is still working out these technicalities needed to see into the dark. And because of this, questions such as, where does a black hole lead to, elude us. One of the most misunderstood concepts about black holes is that, for example, if a black hole appeared near the Earth, we would not be swallowed by it. Eventually, we'd probably die due to a lack of sunlight and oxygen, as the black hole might block our view of the sun. In this sense, our deaths would be indirectly caused by a black hole, but we would not be dragged into the black hole because of its gravity pull. We would simply coexist, for a brief amount of time, with the sleeping dragon. But let's take a quick jaunt and talk briefly about the science of black holes that is relevant today. Let's take a moment to talk through Stephen Hawking's black hole paradox. Stephen Hawking's black hole paradox first beguiled the public 5 decades ago. Since then, researchers have been working around the clock to discover more about black holes. Here's the facts. In 1973, Hawking proposed the black hole information paradox, which stated that radiation from a black hole would scramble any possible information received from it. Problem: it doesn't work with Einstein's theory of general relativity or quantum mechanics. So who should we believe? Which theory should we betray? What do scientists think? And what the heck does it have to do with string theory, which is another word scientists like to couple with black holes? All I can say is this. It's a puzzle. The science is confusing and raw data is, well, raw data. Physicists immediately started refuting Hawking's theory, asking questions such as, how does information get in and out of a black hole in the first place? Good point. And yet, no one knows. The paradox is yet to be solved. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk. Now back to the main feature. If you do a random Google search on black holes and the most frequently asked questions about them, you would find, what happens if a person goes into a black hole? Where does a black hole lead to? Can you survive a black hole? Why are black holes important? Good questions. The answers, in order, are, we do not know, we do not know, we do not know, and you may know where this is going. They are important because so little is known about them, in contrast to other popular science topics. However, the assumption that a person could go into a black hole and survive, and the air of mysticism that surrounds them in general, can be attributed to the numerous popular science novels and films that stretch the imagination where black holes are concerned. Take, for example, the 1979 Disney movie titled The Black Hole. I took it upon myself to watch the Disney movie and felt neutral about, but not overly enthused with, their portrayal of the black hole. The main focus of the movie turned out to be escaping from an evil space scientist and not the black hole. But this isn't a movie review podcast, so the black hole itself was depicted as a huge black abyss surrounded in red. To that point, the general public seems to care most about just knowing what black holes are and what purpose they have in our universe. For example, an article from the Harvard Gazette, Translating Black Holes to the Public in 25 Languages by Alvin Powell, covers the work of a theoretical astrophysicist whose educational videos on space and black holes, including Hawking's theories, have garnered over 1 million views. One video in particular, produced in cooperation with TED-Ed, Can a Black Hole Be Destroyed?, written by Fabio Pachusi, has over 1.6 million views, 26,000 likes, and more than 1,000 comments. Wow. But nothing is better than hearing from an actual astrophysicist who worked directly with the Event Horizon Telescope Project, the organization that captured the image of the black hole. We hear from her now. Welcome, and once again, thank you for being here today. Would you please introduce a little bit about yourself and share a little bit about your background?
Yes, of course. Thank you. I'm very excited to be here and talk to you today. So my name is Leah Medeiros, and I'm currently a postdoc, and that just means that I am not a professor and I'm not a student. I'm kind of in the awkward in between, so that I am, I'm at a different institution from where I got my PhD. I'm doing research independently, but still collaborating with people, but I'm not quite a professor yet. The next step would be to become a professor. And I have a fellowship that's from the National Science Foundation, and it's called the Astronomy and Astrophysics Postdoctoral Fellowship. And that fellowship is a national fellowship, and you can choose where you take it. So I chose to take it to this institute called the Institute for Advanced Study. It's located in Princeton, New Jersey, but it's not actually affiliated with the university. Cool fact about the institute is that it's the institute that Einstein spent the last 20 or so years of his career, which is really fun because I am testing Einstein's theory of gravity in the same building that he himself worked. I actually think it's a different building because I think that the building that I'm in didn't exist at the time, but regardless, it's still kind of fun. And I'm also part of the Event Horizon Telescope's huge worldwide collaboration. And within the collaboration, it's kind of organized into what we call working groups. And that just means that we make kind of subgroups of people. And you know, people are usually part of several different working groups. And each working group is trying to focus on a specific aspect of the project or trying to solve a specific part of, you know, the overall problem. And so I'm currently one of the leads for the working group that focuses on testing gravity with the Event Horizon Telescope. And so I'm doing a lot of work with that. So on a more personal note, I'm originally from Brazil. I've moved around my whole life, kind of grew up around science because my dad's a professor. I went to undergrad at UC Berkeley. I went to UCSB, so University of California, Santa Barbara, for both my master's and my PhD. But I ended up spending only 2 years out of the total six at UCSB, spent 3 years at the University of Arizona in Tucson, and 1 year at the Black Hole Initiative at Harvard. So kind of moved around a lot.
So what got you interested in black holes? Even myself, when I first heard it, I was like, black hole, that sounds so normal. And then yet it isn't.
Yeah, so that's a very good question. So I always describe like kind of the full story. So when I was little, as I've already mentioned, I moved around a lot. So I moved to England when I was 2, and I moved back to Brazil when I was 6, and then I moved to America when I was 10. And so I switched languages several times in that period, and kind of went back and forth between the languages. And from a really early age, I honestly felt really dumb in class because I was always behind, because I was always learning the language still, you know what I mean? And math, ironically, was the only thing that was easy to me because it's the same in every country. And so it's super cliche. I know that this is like a quote from Mean Girls, but it's totally true that this is literally what my life is based on, is the fact that math is the same in every country. And from a really early age, I just kind of focused my efforts on math because I knew that it was going to be worthwhile. And I wasn't just going to waste my time learning a language that would be useless to me in 2 years when I moved again. And it's not that I, you know, don't know how to read and write, but I just focused more on math. And it was in junior year of high school, I was taking calculus, astronomy, and physics. And that's when I really realized why math was universal. And that was a really big moment for little young me, because I've been living my whole life, you know, kind of devoted to math because it's not culture or language or, you know, country dependent. And then I realized that math is actually this really incredible language that we can use to describe the universe. And it's kind of amazing to me that we as humans are actually able to create this or discover it, or I don't even know what the correct terminology would be, because did we really create math, or did we just discover math? Yeah, I think it's more of a philosophical question, but to me, at least, it was really, really amazing to understand that you can use math to make predictions, which is just crazy, right? So black holes, for example, the way that black holes came to be from like a science perspective, like the way that we came to learn about them, Einstein came up with his theory of gravity. And so essentially we had an equation that described gravity in the places that we had tested. But then with this equation, we can ask ourselves, what does this equation predict for the places where we haven't tested? And I think that that's really, really interesting. And this is something that happens, you know, in science a lot, where it's like you develop an equation to describe a particular phenomenon, but then you can ask yourself, well, if this equation is right, what does it predict in these other places that I haven't tested yet? And so these equations predicted this object, this black hole. Everybody thought that this was completely insane, that this would never exist. Even Einstein himself didn't think that this was going to be a real thing. But it turns out that they are, you know, real, which is just crazy that we were able to use math to predict the existence of this thing that was completely beyond our imaginations and seemed completely crazy at the time, but it's actually a real object that we can observe in space. And so anyway, so making full circle here, when I was taking those free classes in high school, I started learning about black holes, and I specifically learned about how black holes affect time. And that was what really did it for me, because in general, I was already getting really interested in black holes and physics and all that stuff just because of, you know, my interest in math. And then it was literally like I just had all these questions that I just could not get answers to because my teachers didn't know. Reached the limits of what they could really answer. And I remember very clearly asking my physics teacher what I had to study in college to study black holes. And he thought about it for a little bit. He's like, oh, probably, you know, astronomy. And it's been over a decade now that I've been going in that direction, doing astronomy and physics to study black holes. And they're still very mysterious. There's still a lot that I don't understand about them, but a lot of the things that I don't understand, it's because we as humans don't understand it yet, which is always kind of fun, but it's still a very active area of research.
I really like that you mentioned that, and also that you said math was universal. Kind of going off of that, why do you think humans and millennials in particular should care about black holes?
Well, for starters, because they're really, really cool, which is super biased of me, I know, but they are just such amazing, incredible, like mind-boggling objects that are just so, so fascinating that I think everybody should know them a little bit. And personally, at least, I feel like they're a pretty easy sell when I explain to people about them. People tend to get interested. But from a more practical point of view, specifically the area of the project that I am working on, one of the ways to think about this is that black holes offer us a really unprecedented way to test fundamental theories. And so I view black holes as these absolutely incredible laboratories that we couldn't possibly hope to create on Earth. Not only that, it'd be really, really dangerous to create it on Earth, so we really don't want to create it on Earth, even if we could. And so we're using these incredible, incredible laboratories to learn about the fundamental theories of the universe. And specifically, I'm talking about what I consider to be the two most important theories in modern physics right now, which is the theory that describes gravity, general relativity, which is Einstein's theory, and the theory that describes really small things, which is quantum mechanics. We don't fully understand how these two theories will interact with each other. And I'm not claiming that the very first picture of a black hole can solve all of the mysteries of how these two theories interact. That is a really, really complicated problem. And there's, you know, an entire army of scientists trying to solve that problem. But I'm just saying that it's kind of the first step in that general direction. That if we want to understand how these two theories interact, learning about black holes is really the way to go. And when you're dealing with learning about the most fundamental theories, the question of like, how could this be useful in everyday life is totally valid for you to be wondering, but it's really hard to answer. And the example that I always give is that when Einstein was developing the theory of general relativity over 100 years ago, people were thinking the same thing, right? Why is this useful? Newtonian physics works just fine on Earth. Sure, we can't explain, for example, the orbit of Mercury around the sun, but like, we don't need to understand the orbit of Mercury around the sun. How is this really going to affect our life? And now 100 years later, we use that theory every single day. GPS, for example, would be completely impossible without understanding general relativity. It would be impossible to, you know, fly all of these spaceships and things without taking into account, you know, because we do like slingshots around planets to go around this other planet. There's all of this really complicated math that takes that into account. It's also super important just for keeping clocks synchronous, like, which is super important for the stock market, actually. Like, being able to agree what time something starts and what time something is sold is really important, actually, for like our modern economic system. And gravity affects clocks and speed affects clocks. And so we need to take into account those things when doing those kinds of calculations. And so these are all things that people 100 years ago couldn't possibly have predicted that we were going to actually end up using in our everyday life. And so, for example, right now, people are trying to develop quantum computers, which would be like a whole revolution on computing. Quantum mechanics has been tested many times in many different ways. We've never found anything wrong with it. But that isn't to say that there couldn't be, right? We haven't tested everything. There's always more you can test, right? And so, for example, one potential outcome of this is that by taking pictures of black holes, we can learn something about how these two theories interact, the theory of gravity and theory of quantum mechanics. And then by learning about that, we learn something fundamental about how one of these theories is either incomplete or missing some other component. And that could fundamentally change how we create quantum computers in the future or something like that, right? So the possibilities are really limitless and very hard to predict, but the most fundamental level of our understanding of how like very basic things work, like how gravity works. I get asked the question a lot about like, why should we care about astronomy? Why should we do astronomy as a society? And the answer that I like to give to that question a lot of times is not a super practical answer, but it's almost like a nostalgic answer. And the way that I like to explain this is that if you actually think about it, astronomy is the very first attempt at science. The very first time that early humans tried to do something scientific was astronomy, right? So if you look back at the most ancient civilizations that we have any records from, they were charting the stars. And, you know, it wasn't super science in the sense that we look at nowadays, but they were trying to understand the behavior of these celestial objects, trying to track positions and changes in positions as a function of the time, and trying to predict when particular objects are going to be in view or not in view and where they will be placed in the sky. And that was the very first science. And it's just, it's been such an integral part of the human experience since the very beginning of civilization. And I just feel like it's just, at least to me, it's just this very amazing thing to think about that like this is something that all humans throughout millennia have had in common, that we've all looked up at the sky and wondered what was out there and wanted to understand our place in the universe. And we've obviously made a lot more progress now with these huge telescopes than, you know, early Egyptians could have done. But it's kind of amazing that after all this time, we're still asking similar questions and still interested in similar things. And I feel like it kind of brings us all together in the same wonder of the outside universe.
Yeah, that really ties in nicely with my next question, which is about the theories. So a large part of my podcast focuses on Hawking's black hole information paradox. And I wanted to know, because I've been reading a lot of articles where scientists are saying, oh, we're going to have to throw out the theory of general relativity or quantum mechanics in order to solve the paradox. So what is your view on that? Are you in favor of throwing out one theory to solve the paradox? Or do you think that actually those are the key to solving the paradox?
So it's not so much like a choice of like, oh, what do you want or what do you not want or what, you know, what do I like believe in or anything like that. My view on this is very much just, you know, the entire point of science is to do experiments. And so we will only ever understand the answer to your question through experiments. And that's the part that I specifically am working on, is trying to use black holes in space to understand things like this. And so I try really hard, actually, to not have like personal beliefs about like what I think the outcome will be. But I am mostly just really focused on trying to come up with ways to actually do experiments to try to understand that better without any, you know, preconceived bias of what I expect. I think that, you know, there are a lot of people that have spent their entire career coming up with different ways to combine these two theories. The entire field of quantum gravity is huge and full of a lot of people that work really, really hard on putting these things together. And so there's a lot of different theories for how we could combine them. And it's not as simple as like choosing, oh, you're going to get rid of this one or not. I feel like all of the theories kind of take bits and pieces of quantum and GR and keep some things and maybe change a few things. You know, there's some complications. So like, for example, if you've heard of string theory, that's one attempt at trying to put these things together. There are people that feel, have very strong opinions about string theory versus loop quantum gravity versus whatever else you can come up with. But especially because of what I work on, I try really hard to kind of stay away from all of that. Like I have friends, obviously, I talk to people in those fields, but I don't want to get emotionally attached to any of the particular theories. And I just want to be able to test them completely without any bias.
Do you see a lot of preconceived bias in your work, like towards one theory or another?
Not in my work, no. I think, you know.
Or not in your work, but like by others
who do similar work. I mean, I just mean even like within the whole collaboration. I don't think that's really a problem. I think that, you know, scientists are humans. That is just a part of the equation. So you do always need to take into account the human element and kind of be very cautious about that. And so there will be people that might use theoretical arguments for why they think one theory is better than the other, but that's very different than what I'm doing where I'm trying to actually like test these things, right? And I must be careful too that when I say like, oh, I want to test these things, there's not a specific thing that string theory predicts that I can test. But the way that I look at it is that if we ever have any hope of testing anything that these theories could predict, black holes are the way to go. And if there is something wrong with the theory of general relativity or the theory of quantum mechanics, the best place to look is with black holes. So I do want to be careful. I don't want to like oversell what we're doing. There's no specific prediction from loop quantum gravity or string theory that the Event Horizon Telescope can test. But what I do want to say is that when I first started grad school, I had this kind of, you know, crazy idea of using black holes in space to test fundamental theories. And that was just a complete and total pipe dream at the time. That was not something that had ever been done. And this was just 7 years ago. And so much has changed in even just 7 years since I first started grad school, that it's just kind of amazing. And what I always like to say is that we're actually like in a whole new era of astrophysics. It's the dawn of a new era. Where we can actually use black holes in space to actually like study gravity, which has never been possible before because we've just never been able to perform experiments like that. So not just with the EHT, but also with gravitational waves. So we can use both of these experiments to test fundamental theories with actual real black holes in space, which is just crazy. And so, you know, it's just the beginning. I always say that. It's amazing what we've been able to accomplish in just 7 years, where before it was just, you know, we went from zero to two, which is huge. No experiments to two experiments is really exciting. And, you know, someday we might be able to get a little bit of a handle on how to put these two theories together.
That is really, really fascinating. And I really want to know what your reaction was to see that black hole image for the first time. I mean, I read on Twitter some reactions, and one Twitter user said, "I bet this black hole sees dead people." Now, if that was sincere or not, we'll never know. But I want to know what your reaction was when you saw the image for the first time.
That is a very good question. So I'm going to give you a little bit of background. So I primarily work on theoretical aspects of this project. So I focus more on running simulations to predict what the black hole might look like, predict different properties of the image, or, you know, how the image may or may not be variable, things like that. But because of kind of the excitement around this first image, I kind of went on a little tangent away from my usual work and participated in the team of people that made these images. And so I even flew across the country back to Harvard for the summer to collaborate with some of the people there that were working on making this image. And so I was in the room the first time that we made the image. I had my, you know, laptop going, and I was running the script also. I don't think I was the first one, but regardless, we all pressed the button at the same time because nobody wanted to, you know, we didn't want any one person to be able to say that they did it first. We wanted to do it together as a team, which was really awesome. And we all, you know, saw that image appear in our laptop. And it was just so incredible because to me, it's the same kind of awe that I was trying to explain earlier when just thinking about the fact that, you know, we were able to predict the existence of black holes based on this, on these theories. It's crazy to me. We had never seen a black hole. We had never seen an image of anything even close to this. But using the theories that we have for everything else, we were able to run simulations to actually predict what that was going to look like. And I just think that that's just such an incredible feat for humanity in general and for science as a whole. It's just incredible that we made a prediction based on all these theories and we were dead on, right? Like completely exactly right, which is just crazy. And so it was very kind of awe-inspiring. And it was also kind of a little bit of relief because there's a lot that could have gone wrong in this experiment. And even just the fact that the instrument itself and the experiment itself worked is incredible. And the fact that it worked so well, like we got really lucky. That was a lot better image than we actually expected. Because this thing, I mean, if you think of the ring from our perspective here on Earth is about the size of if you were to get like a orange or a donut and put it on the surface of the moon and then come back to the Earth and take a picture. So it's the highest resolution humanity's ever achieved. It's insane resolution. It's so tiny. And we didn't expect it to work as well as it did, if I'm being completely honest. I at least was very surprised that it was as clear and as beautiful as it is.
But what a feat, especially for working so hard towards this one goal. And my next question for you is, what was it like to work with such a global and diversified team? I was looking at the website and there's like laboratories everywhere and scientists coming from everywhere. So how was it working with a team like that?
It's wonderful, but also very challenging from practical point of view, because, you know, time zones are a thing and there's always somebody that has to wake up at 4 a.m. and we feel very bad for whoever that is at that time. So there are obviously, you know, some like practical challenges, but it's really awesome and really, really wonderful to get to know all these different people in very different areas of the world. Having moved around my whole life, I've always really enjoyed international friendships or traveling and, you know, different cultures and getting to know different cultures. So I personally really, really enjoy it. So one of the aspects of this project that I think is really cool is the fact that if you do the calculation of what size telescope you would need to see an orange on or a donut on the surface of the moon, it's about the size of the Earth that you would need. Obviously, we can't just build one giant Earth-sized telescope. That would be a little outside of our budget. By like several orders of magnitude. But what we do instead is we use a bunch of telescopes that already existed on Earth and we put them all together. So almost by definition, we require telescopes spread all over the world. And so it requires people spread all over the world so that you can, you know, run those telescopes. And so it's a really, really cool global effort because you don't just need people, but you need the instruments and you need, you know, all the countries and whoever is in charge of all of these telescopes to kind of buy into this idea as well. So it's really, really cool to have everybody come together like this. And I remember, because I just talked about time zones, one of the things that I think is really cool, just for you to get an idea of how global this collaboration really is, somebody at some point made like a map of labeling where everybody's located and looking at time zones. And we have people spread over all of the time zones. And the biggest gap that we have between time zones is like 4 hours.
A large part of this podcast also focuses on cultural perspectives when it comes to black holes and how societies and the people within them view black holes, if that's the same or differently. So my next question for you is one that I've been thinking about as I've been reading all these articles about black holes. Do you see a disconnect between almost hyped up popular science articles about black holes and the actual science behind them?
Yes and no. So there are several things that the popular articles or pop culture in general do get wrong. So like one of the examples I always like to talk about is the movie Interstellar. So I actually never saw the movie because I like can't bring myself to watch sci-fi. There's so many things wrong. I just can't handle it. But Anyways, but I've seen the picture so many times, right? And that was one of the movies that got like a ton of hype about how they, you know, simulated the image of the black hole and how they actually talked to scientists about it. And the scientist that they talked about is this amazing world-renowned scientist that I have a lot of respect for. But what's funny is that when that movie came out, we had already been simulating those same images for like a while. And ours were just as high resolution, but you know, the media blows it up as if, oh, Hollywood was able to solve this unsolvable problem. And I'm like, yeah, we've been doing this for a while. And what's really interesting too, is that they purposely did it wrong. In the movie, you see this ring that's symmetric, which in the situation that they have and the, you know, system that they have, that wouldn't be the case. And the scientists that they were talking about definitely told them that no, it's not going to be symmetric, but they just thought it looked prettier. So it's just hilarious to me because there's all this hype about, oh, look, we did this crazy calculation and it took all this time on this supercomputer and we talked to the scientist and blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, we still just chose to do it wrong because we thought it looked prettier. So that's just kind of like a small example of kind of what happens in these kinds of situations in general, right? So a lot of things are bent for the media and for pop culture just to get a little bit more of a reaction from the public. But one of the specific things that I always like to kind of clear up, and when I give talks, I have a silly meme where there's a black hole and it looks kind of like a little Pac-Man and it's like sucking everything up. I always say that I'm really trying to be a spokesperson for black holes. And, you know, they're fine. They're quite friendly. They're quite chill. They're not that aggressive. They're not that dangerous. It's really just if you get too close, they just like their personal space. Well, what I mean by that is the following. If I were to magically replace the sun with a black hole tomorrow, we would all die for various reasons. Because we would freeze, because we wouldn't have the sun's light, and blah, blah, blah. But if we ignore all of the practical reasons why we would die, if you just look at the orbit of the Earth can orbit a black hole that has the same mass as the sun in the exact same way as it can orbit the sun. And it can be stable, and it can orbit it forever until something messes up the stable orbit. What I mean by that is that if you are far enough away, you cannot tell the difference between the gravitating black hole or any other object that's spherically symmetric and gravitating. It's really just because you can get too close, right? So essentially it's like all these other objects have surfaces. If you replace the Earth by a Earth-sized black hole, what would the difference be? Is that now instead of us getting pulled down to the Earth so that then we hit the surface of the Earth and stop, we would then be able to fall all the way down to the center. And as you get closer to the center, you get a stronger gravitational field if you imagine a black hole, right? And so the difference in that case would be that you don't have the surface that keeps you from going all the way down to the center. And it's only when you get really, really close to the black hole that it becomes a really big problem. So in the example of the Earth, the black hole that you would make out of the Earth, the event horizon for that black hole would have about the size of a marble. So imagine a little marble, you squeeze the entire Earth into a little marble. That's the size of the event horizon. So as long as you're not within that size, you're like probably safe. The event horizon is really the limit between when light can escape and when light can't escape. We obviously can't move as fast as light, so we wouldn't be safe. We would have to be a bit farther away to be safe. My point still stands about if you're far enough away from a black hole, it's fine. The same way that if you're far enough away from the sun, it's fine. If you're far enough away from any other gravitating object, it's fine. It's really just if you get too close, and black holes allow you to get too close because they don't have a surface. So for example, right now, our entire solar system is in orbit around a supermassive black hole, and we're fine. Fine. Not scared, not worried, not dangerous, not a problem. But you know, the media likes to demonize them a little bit. So anyways, they're cute, they're fluffy. I have a little stuffed animal black hole with adorable little eyes.
Oh my goodness, that is great. So my last final question for you is kind of going off what you just said about how they're, you know, not too dangerous until you get too close, and they will allow you to get too close because they don't have a surface. Do you think there will be a point where humanity will want to go into a black hole if we're not already there yet? And what do you think in a black hole? Is there anything, or is it just matter that it's consuming?
Good question. Okay, so I'm going to give you a couple answers for that. So first, my most scientifically correct answer is we do not know. We will never know by definition. And scientifically, that's really the correct answer. So let me explain that. So I just said that nothing can escape the event horizon, right? So I said light can't escape the event horizon. Well, when I say nothing can escape the event horizon, I mean literally nothing, not even information. And this is like a fundamental thing about black holes, is that information cannot leave a black hole. So by definition, we will never actually be able to perform any experiments about what's inside of a black hole. However, that being said, if you remember the explanation that I gave about how the theory of general relativity predicted the existence of black holes, what we can do is we can use theories that we have tested elsewhere and then ask ourselves, what does this theory predict for what would happen inside of the black hole? It's weird because we can't test that particular theory in that particular extreme, but it's a, you know, kind of as good as what as we can do, at least for right now. And obviously, you know, black holes in general are at the very limit of what we understand. And so it could be that the current theories that we have are not correct. And, you know, in a few years, we'll have some more tests, we'll come up with new theories, and they might predict something different for the inside of the black hole. I just like to keep all of that out in the open about, like, everything that I'm about to say is based on theories, but we fundamentally will never be able to actually test exactly what happens within the black holes. So all of that being said, it could be that it's all, you know, rainbows and unicorns and pink elephants, but probably not. So according to the theory of general relativity, what happens is that all of the matter is enclosed in an infinitely small space. Okay, so you have a point that's infinitely small. That essentially just means that it's going to be collapsing forever in the center of the black hole, which I know seems completely counterintuitive because you'd have literally infinite density, zero volume. This doesn't seem to make any sense whatsoever. But then you have to remember that mass and energy are actually the same thing, and you can convert between them. And so intuitively, at least when I'm talking to the public, I like to kind of throw it out there that if putting all this mass in an infinitely small space seems ridiculous to you, you can think about it as energy and it might seem less ridiculous because we don't actually know exactly what form matter would have, but it's probably energy and it's probably not going to have any form of matter like we understand here, such as, you know, atoms or particles or things like that, because it's going to be crushed to something that's smaller than all of these atoms and particles that we're used to. To answer the question of what would happen inside of a black hole, or, oh, would we go into a black hole? Well, according to our theories, if you go into a black hole, you will have the most complete death imaginable. On Earth, if you die, you die, right? But all of the atoms and molecules and whatever that make you up get to live on and get recycled into new things. However, if you fall into a black hole, every single particle that you are made of will no longer exist.
Wow, okay.
So anyways, I wouldn't recommend it.
Yeah.
And I know that in pop culture, people like to talk a lot about using black holes as like pathways into other parts of the universe or other universes, or other dimensions or whatever. So let me explain that a little bit, because it's not completely made up, okay? So what happens is that according to the theories of general relativity, Einstein's theory of gravity, we have these equations, okay? And these equations, the way that it works essentially is you need to come up with one equation that's going to solve this other equation, okay? And one equation is like, you know, for example, a black hole is this one equation that solves Einstein's equations, are these complicated set of equations, and we come up with different solutions to those equations. And these solutions are essentially different geometries. So you can imagine black holes as a hole. That's your whole geometry. And you can imagine, for example, the opposite of a black hole, which would be a white hole. You can imagine the white hole geometry. And then you can imagine something that looks like a wormhole, right? And it's the wormhole geometry. And it just so happens that if you try to put those geometries into the Einstein equations and actually solve the Einstein equations, they do actually solve the Einstein equations. Crazy. Right.
And yeah.
So totally wild. And you're probably sitting there like, wait, so wormholes and white holes are possible? This is crazy. I thought you were going to tell me that they're insane. Well, hold on.
Okay.
So just because a particular geometry solves the Einstein equations does not necessarily mean it's actually realizable in the universe. Okay. So for example, for some of these solutions that have these weird geometries like wormholes or white holes or all these other things, a lot of those solutions for you to be able to actually create them in the universe, even though the result doesn't break anything, right? So it's like the resulting geometry doesn't break anything. But how would you actually get to that?
Hmm.
You can't come up with any way of getting there. And some of them, the only way to get there would be to use negative matter, which is not a thing. Nothing has negative mass. Even antimatter doesn't have negative mass. So doesn't seem like it's really possible, but that doesn't mean that, you know, 100 years from now, some brilliant scientists won't come up with a way to create a wormhole. So we can't prove them wrong, but they're probably not real.
In terms of your research, what's the next thing you're looking at? Are you going to try to get like another picture of the black hole? How is that going to be possible?
So the black hole that you saw a picture of is a black hole that's in the center of one of the nearby galaxies. Nearby, it's 55 million light years away. But
okay. Nearby is a relative term here.
Relative term, yes. It's one of the closest galaxies. And so it's one of the largest black holes in the sky from our point of view. And it's about a billion times the mass of the sun, actually 6.5 billion. And it's pretty far away. But in our own galaxy, there's also a black hole in the center. There's actually hundreds of little black holes spread around, but then there's like one massive, supermassive black hole in the center. And the supermassive black hole in the center is called Sagittarius A star because it's in the direction of the Sagittarius constellation. And back in the day, people saw a point of light in that direction. They had no idea what it was. And so they called it, oh yes, this is Sagittarius A. It's the brightest one. We'll just name it A. Very creative. Yeah. And then as telescopes improved, they realized that there's actually a smaller thing, that A is actually a conglomerate. And inside of A, there's like smaller little things. And so then they're like, oh yes, we'll put a little asterisk on that one. It's like that little one. Yeah, that one. So okay. Anyway, the name stuck and it's called Sagittarius A star. And it's literally a little asterisk. But it just goes to show you that this is kind of a recurring thing in astronomy, is that we discover things and have no idea what they are and put a name to them based on our best guess at the time, and then realize that actually they're not that at all, and then the name sticks. So another example is this thing called a quasar. And it was named a quasar because they said it was a quasi-stellar object.
So they just smushed it all together and came up with quasar.
It's actually a supermassive black hole that's like super huge and super powerful and like billions of times the mass of a star.
Could that suck us in without even trying?
So actual black hole part is actually the same. It's just like bigger or smaller. But what makes them so powerful is that there's a lot of stuff falling into them. And so like what makes them powerful is not actually the black hole itself, but what happens to matter as it's falling into the black hole. So as the matter is falling in, it like spirals around and creates this like really hot plasma. So it gets so hot that it becomes plasma and everything becomes ionized, which just means that you just have, you know, all the electrons and all the protons are separated. And so you have all these charged particles moving around and everything is super, super hot. And that creates a ton of light. And so, for example, it's possible that a quasar can emit light as the rest of the entire galaxy that it's in. Incredibly powerful, crazy, crazy object. But they're not any more dangerous than any other thing of that mass. It's just that because there's so much stuff falling in, it all gets hot, it emits a ton of light. And so they're very crazy objects. But anyways, but they're called quasi-stellar objects or quasars, which is totally not what they are. So that kind of thing happens a lot. To answer your original question, what am I doing now or what's going to come next is this black hole in the center of our galaxy.
Okay.
So we're trying to take an image of Sagittarius A star, and it's a black hole that's very kind of near and dear to our hearts because it's the black hole that's in our own neighborhood. It's our black hole. And so astronomers have been studying this black hole for a really long time. And actually, just a few weeks ago, there was a new Nobel Prize in physics announced, and the people that got that Nobel Prize have been working on estimating the mass of Sag A star for over a decade. So we know the mass of Sag A star with more accuracy than most humans know their own weight, because the fluctuations that humans have in their weight throughout the day is more than the uncertainty in the mass of this black hole.
So we're very certain about the mass.
Yep, which is crazy because it's, you know, a black hole very far away. But so anyway, so people just got a Nobel Prize for making that measurement. And so we do plan on creating an image of the black hole. We've already done the observations. We're just working on analyzing the data. There's a few different reasons why that black hole is harder to image than the black hole in the center of M87. It's about a thousand times smaller. Problem for resolution because it's also a thousand times closer. So those two things cancel out. But the fact that it's smaller means that it moves faster. And I don't actually mean that like the black hole itself is moving, but it's the image changes faster. So you can almost imagine that like the image size changes, the amount of time that it would change that it would take to change a big image is longer than the amount of time it would take to change a smaller image. If you look at like a simulation, for example, if a black hole is 1,000 times smaller, you can just pretend that that simulation is running 1,000 times faster and you'll get about the same, the right idea. So it just scales with mass. Essentially, the silly analogy that I like to use is that it's like we, you know, we took a picture of this, you know, old man who's sitting there calmly and, you know, very chill. And then now we're trying to take a picture of a little toddler that will not stay still.
I was going to say, because it's like closer, it would seem to be easier, but no.
Yep. The other part is that we also have to look through half the galaxy. And there's a lot of dust in the galaxy. Nobody cleans. So, but actually.
We need that black hole to suck up everything. Like, suck up all the dust. It's our little vacuum.
In the system where like matter is falling into the black hole, it doesn't actually, it's not a very good vacuum actually.
Wait, is it?
It spits out a significant percentage of the stuff that falls in. So just because of the conservation of angular momentum and the fact that there's like this really strong magnetic field and the magnetic field interacts with the charged particles, what ends up happening, at least what we think, this is, you know, currently best understanding, is that there's this like big poofy disk of matter and it's all spiraling towards the black hole. But some of that matter will get excited by the magnetic field and get expelled on these like huge jets. It vacuums up some stuff and then throws the rest. Not recommend getting a black hole as a vacuum.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your insight with us. And I wish you the best in your research moving forward.
Thank you. I also wish you the best.
If you'd like to read more about Dr. Medeiros' work, please visit her website at www.liamedeiros.com. That's www.liamedeiros.com. There you'll find summaries of her past and ongoing research, including her work on testing gravity with the EHT. There's also some more information about the researcher herself and the kinds of outreach programs she does. So, once again, that's www.liamedeiros.com. Black holes are a source of constant imagination and fascination. They are awe-provoking and terrifying at the same time. What else do humans know of in our universe, or anywhere else, quite frankly, that could possibly lead us to another universe and possibly kill us instantly at the same time? Take, for example, The Jaunt, a short story written by Stephen King. The story is set in a futuristic Earth, where jaunting is the newest form of interstellar travel. What some people don't know, however, is that jaunting ultimately takes your mind's molecular particles apart on the journey through space and black hole, as it turns out, and reforms them on the other side. This is because when you are jaunting, you are literally tearing a hole in the fabric of space. But there's a catch. You have to be sedated for the journey, otherwise you'll go mad. Unfortunately, and this is an official spoiler alert, the protagonist's son decides to stay awake for the trip and suffers through an eternity of emptiness and space-time, resulting in him going mad and tearing his eyes out at the end of the trip. Wonderfully written story. Highly recommend it if you are into science fiction. If you are not, steer clear. I'd like to end by briefly thinking about cultural perspectives of black holes, because I think it is a facet to black holes that people do not really think about, but is truly fascinating. The truth of the matter is, what black holes could mean to a certain group of people, they can mean something very different to another group of people. This has nothing to do with race or ethnicity. It all comes down to how societies, and therefore people, view science and how science functions in their society, for good or for worse. We can also kill two birds in one stone at the same time by talking through society controls science media and not science journalism, and this is why they portray black holes and their very existence differently. Disclaimer, there are no articles or research scientists out there talking about this, so take this with a grain of salt. Let's break this down by using the Event Horizon Telescope project as an example. This is a global project. Research laboratories and telescopes are all over the world, in the United States, in Chile, Hawaii, and China. There's even talk of placing one in Africa soon, and maybe someday in the future, on the moon or even Mars. But more important is the fact that while the telescopes are stationary, for the moment, the research scientists who work with them come from numerous universities and institutions from around the world. MIT, Caltech, Radboud, Hiroshima University, and Instituto de Astronomia. To what extent societal influences have on the institutions would have to have more airtime than this episode entirely. Maybe next time.
Since space really is the final frontier, I believe that all our answers about black holes will continue to lie in space. Until next time, I'm Catherine Hannon, and thanks for listening to Inner Dimensions.
Many thanks to Dr. Leah Medeiros for taking time out of her schedule and contributing to this podcast. Dr. Vaughn Anderson for designing a class which made this project possible. Tom Roberts for offering advice on black holes and media consumption.